Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Ah, yeah. Hey, this is Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, and I am Carol the Coach, and I am here to help you with, well, I'm here to help you with your sexual addiction, or if you're in love with somebody who's a sex addict, I'm here to help you cope with that. And this is the only show on iTunes that you can go to find out more about sexual addiction. Now, you know, clearly, one of the things that I know to be true is that, unfortunately, sexual addiction is one of those things that oftentimes does not get talked about. And you don't know where to go and you don't know where to turn. And certainly, if you've got good relationship skills, good interrogative skills, you figure out where you need to go to get the answers. That's what you're doing here. You're here because you have inquiring skills, you have talked to the right people, and they've told you this is the place to go for information about how to get healthy and how to heal. Now tonight, we've got Paul Hartman on, and he is going to be talking about the deeper recovery that one can experience when they find the proper formula to heal. Now, he's got over 30 years of treating clients and their partners, and he is on a double mission. He wants to help you get sober, stay sober, and teach you how to progress to deeper recovery. He also wants to talk about those things that clearly make a difference in your therapy. You know, your childhood issues, understanding the emotions that you may have repressed or unfortunately denied because you didn't think it was safe to share them. So I'm looking so forward to working with him. And you know, this is a show where you can call 646-595-3284 and ask any questions that you would like. Now, I got an email this week, and it said, Carol, I recently discovered your show in podcast form. I enjoy it and appreciate all the great help that you provide. Well, thank me, Tammy. It's my guests. They are amazing. So this woman says, I'm struggling to know the right, well, the best thing to do. She'd like me to help answer her question. She's been seeing this man, Tom, for 4 months now. We've worked together, and I've known him as a coworker for 2.5 years. been officially divorced for 1.5 years, and he has a small, a young son. Over the 6 months prior to dating, we talked more and more, lots of flirting, nervousness, anxiety, etc. I have strong feelings for him. I am attracted to, admire, and respect so many of his qualities. He has a great personality and has wonderful beliefs. That includes the not-so-desirable ones, like when he told me he's a sexaholic. He had been distant and very different the last week, and then he told me. He goes to SA, has been abstinent for over a year, has a sponsor, and a lot on his plate. The sponsor wants him to be abstinent for 6 months. How do I help? They're good physical boundaries for us. Okay, first of all, she says, how do I help? Well, it sounds like you're open to the fact somebody can have a sexual addiction, and you're wanting to help, so already you're not judging to the point where you want to stop seeing him. So that is helpful in and of itself. And what are good physical boundaries? Well, he has made it clear he doesn't want to stop seeing me, and I don't want to stop either. And what we heard is, that he's working on abstinence. So I would continue, Tammy, at abstinence. You know, I would do whatever it takes to follow his lead on that. And here's why. You know, when you're in a relationship with somebody and they don't have a specific sexual problem, it's pretty much a mutual decision. But in this situation, he's told you he's a sexaholic, and so that means but there has to be even more communication about what he needs, what he doesn't need, what's healthy, what's not healthy, what are contracts he may have set with himself, with his sponsor, with his 12-step group. And then, though I don't believe in being codependent, I also believe that if you want somebody to stay in recovery, you have to respect their recovery boundaries. So, I would definitely not engage in any kind of sexual activity at the present time. He said, he made it clear he doesn't want to stop seeing me, and I don't want to stop either. What can I do to ensure that I am helpful with his recovery? Distant because he isn't all that interested in me, or is he conflicted? Well, you've heard me say it before. I believe when a woman asks the question, she probably already knows the answer. And certainly anything I might add right here is total assumption. What I do know is people who have sex addictions, who are sexaholics, oftentimes do have intimacy disorders. And so as the two of you begin to get closer, it's very common. I'm not saying this is him. I don't know him. But it is very common for there to be some distance and some come here, go away tendencies. And what I mean by that is 1 minute he'll act super excited and the next minute he'll be pushing you away because of his own fears. Now, the way you wrote this email, Tammy, makes me believe that you felt that his distance was in direct relation to the fact that he was going to tell you that he was a sexaholic. That kind of thing is very, very, very scary. I just had a man today who said, I've met somebody, I really like her, she's really spunky, really perky. I don't know when to tell her that I'm a sex addict. Well, I think that's an individual issue that needs to be answered by the couple, depending on who they are. However, just in the same way as I tell people to wait 4 seasons before they get married, even if they know they're in love at 3 months, they should go at least 12 months. When you're a sex addict, you need to have developed the trust in the relationship so that you can have connection and the safety to talk about the tough issues. And I always tell my men and my women, please don't talk to the person you're dating before 6 months. Now, one of the reasons I say that is because people tend to jump the gun when it comes to relationships. They get involved too quickly, sexually, and they share way too much with the other person. As a matter of fact, before I even got into sexual addiction, I did a lot of singles coaching. And I really believed that it was imperative to not share anything but the bare basics about your previous relationships for at least 4 to 6 months. Now, you may think, wow, that's a long time not to share a very personal and intimate part of your past. Here's what I believe. When you are dating somebody, you're supposed to just be having fun, concentrating on each other and how that person makes you feel. But if you're talking about your ex and all the things that he or she did wrong in the relationship, you've got a ghost in your relationship. I don't think that's healthy. And so I want you to wait at least 4 to 6 months before you even go into any details about your past. I mean, yeah, your person you date will benefit from understanding what went wrong and what went right. But unfortunately, too many people use their dates as confidants. And that is not what they are. They are focusing on what's right about this relationship, not what went wrong in your past. So I really encourage people to maintain some boundaries. But Tammy says, we both want intimacy. I want to see him happy and healthy. How do I ask more about his particular addiction? Is that even my business? Okay, let's see here. They've only been seeing each other 4 months now. He's already said he's a sexaholic. So yes, I would say it's probably your business because he brought it up. Probably told you about it too early, but you may go ahead and ask him just very, very basic questions. Nothing that's going to be too detailed. Because I tell you what, you're still supposed to be concentrating on whether you like the guy. Now, I know it already looks like you do. And that's fantastic. What I would encourage you to do is to read up on what sex addiction is so that you know the right questions to ask. She says, what does he need in order to view sex in a healthy way? To have real intimacy and love, enjoy a happy relationship, what can I do to help? Boy, these are all questions that she needs to be asking him, not me. And it sounds like she's taking this relationship very seriously. And I would say, Tammy, please lighten up. I do know that at month 2, 3, 4, 5, you can be so attracted that you think this person is the one. But right now, I would like for you to imagine that you're just enjoying him in the moment. I want you to stay in the present. I want you to decide what's working for you today. And if by month 6, 7, 8, 9, you're still really involved and you both have agreed on exclusivity and you really, really trust him, then I would save some of those questions for that period of time. He says, any words of advice would be much appreciated. I'm sorry for all the questions. I want to do the right thing, and I'm still a little nervous. I haven't felt strongly for anyone in 7 years. Thank you in advance, Carol. So, this Tammy sounds like a great person. She sounds like she's a wonderful catch, and she's asking very intelligent questions. So I hope, Tammy, you heard me say that you need to talk to him about the issues, but you don't want the relationship today to totally revolve around his sexual addiction. You want to see if you can really just enjoy him for who he is. You want to stay in the moment. You want to look at what's working. And then I always say we make decisions based on our head, our heart, and our gut. And what that means is You need to determine, what do you think about this guy? What are Tom's strengths and his weaknesses? How do you feel about him? That's the emotions. And then, what does your gut tell you about him? Can you trust him? Is he somebody that is trustworthy? That is super important. So pay attention to what you think, how you feel, and what you know intuitively. And I would even encourage you to write it down, Tammy, because when you write it down, you're more likely to be able to go back and assess if things have changed or not. So again, I totally appreciate your questions. It's hard to get in a relationship with someone who reveals that they're a sex addict, and you want to take it slow, stay in the moment. And stay tuned to this show, because we are going to be talking about deeper recovery and the formula to heal with Paul Hartman, who is an expert in this field and has worked on intensives with couples, with sex addicts, for many, many years. And so we had him on the show a couple of months ago, and we got so engaged in conversation, we really didn't get to finish the interview. So I said, hey, Paul, would you come back on the show? So, Paul Hartman, welcome to the Sex Help with Carol the Coach show. How are you doing tonight?
Good, Carol. Thanks for having me back. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. I mean, what the information that you gave us was so valuable, and whenever we're talking about sexual recovery, you know, it's difficult to know what to look for and when to feel, you know, when you're an addict, when to know, actually, when you're dealing with that deeper recovery that is so necessary in healing the trauma and the wounds. So I don't know if you remembered where we stopped last time, but I do. And I just kind of want to summarize, if I can, the fact that you have some specific feelings about sexual addiction. Do you believe that it is a disease in the same way that other addictions, like substance abuse, are a disease?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there was a lot of debate about this when Patrick Carnes first came on the scene back in the early 80s. If there are any older listeners out there right now, you might remember that Phil Donahue was sort of the Oprah of the day back then, and he used to have Pat on routinely and repetitively, and sometimes he'd have him on a panel with other mental health professionals, usually psychiatrists, and they would really get into this thing in a debate format of not only can sex be an addiction, but back then they were still talking about, can a behavior be an addiction, you know, as opposed to a substance. That was pretty well established. There was no debate there. But today we call those behavioral addictions process addictions. And I would say, for the most part, we're past the debate stage. Behaviors or process addictions are every bit as addictive as substances. And in case people wonder how that could be, it's all about changing the chemistry in the brain. So if I'm taking any kind of substance, I'm changing my brain chemistry. But the interesting thing is, if I'm doing certain things behaviorally, I'm also changing my brain chemistry. And probably one of the most powerful ways behaviorally to change brain chemistry is with sexual acting out. So, this is an exciting time to be in addiction, because we're really learning so much. And with the medical technology that allows us to actually look at the living brain in the form of brain scans, we know a lot more now about what's going on with the addict brain than
we
knew.
That things are changing in the brain, as opposed to just knowing that intuitively, we're seeing brain activity that proves neurobiochemistry and the changes that are going on, and the neuropsychiatry that occurs, the circuitry, the changes within the brain. You're right. It's very, very exciting. Yeah. And you know what I think it does, Paul, is I think that for a lot of people, they feel like they should know better, that they should know how to stop something like a sexual addiction. And now that we understand how the brain functions, we realize that we have to impact the brain differently if change is ever going to occur.
Right. Well, the thing we learned decades ago with alcoholism is that no alcoholic was ever successful in getting sober and staying sober through willpower. And so in this day and age, I don't know why anybody that's having trouble with acting out sexually believes that they should be able to control that or have power over that through willpower. I mean, it simply can't be done. The good news is that with help, sobriety is definitely possible. And not only, I'm not just talking about short-term sobriety, and I'm not describing some kind of a lifestyle where, well, this is addiction, so you've got to expect slips or relapses from time to time. No, that's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm saying that we know for sure that sex addicts can establish a solid sobriety just like an alcoholic can, that is consistent, long-term, uninterrupted. And I'm saying this primarily for partners. If your addict can become that sober person, then maybe it's worth considering doing the work to create a new relationship and be with the addict. But if it's going to be the up and down and in and out, sober one day, acting out the next, then I wouldn't want to go on record as saying anybody should stay in that kind of a situation.
I understand you correctly. What you're saying is, although you realize that it's up to the individuals themselves, you really look for people who have the proper support, that are working hard at developing the committee or the infrastructure to assist them in not using sex. You know, and when they do that, they're much more successful than if they try to white knuckle it, because it is not through willpower they can evoke change. It is through developing the right resources.
Right, right. Let me go back to your original question, Carol, which was, how do you know if you're actually dealing with this disease we call sex addiction? Actually, we evaluate this, we look at this through a lens that's the same lens, whether we're looking at sex addiction or any other addiction. I mean, the characteristics or the symptoms are pretty much the same. I've got a list of 10 symptoms, and I'm actually not going to talk about all 10 of them here on the interview, but I want to pull out some that addicts most typically identify with. And of course, the big thing here is efforts to stop.
Right.
One of the tools that we recommend for recovering sex addicts, we use this phrase, think it all the way through. And what we're talking about is, if you only think about acting out, if you only think about what happens on the front end, which is the dopamine release and the high that goes with any addiction, it might be tempting to act out. But if you think it all the way through, it always ends in despair. And, I mean, that's what brings addicts to treatment in the first place. Oftentimes they'll say, the fun's gone out of it, and I'm still in the despair. But even though it ends in despair and they try to stop, they can't stop. So that's the biggest symptom right there, efforts to stop, and they can't stop. Today, one of the most prominent forms of acting out is internet pornography. And I know Patrick Carnes was on your show not so long ago. He may have said this. Internet porn is the crack cocaine of sex addiction. It's a form of pornography that is so easily available. A lot of it is actually free. You don't have to go to a paid site. You can find plenty of pornography without even having to pay for it. And it's anonymous. So that's a very prominent form of acting out. And even if it typically sex addicts will have several different behaviors in acting out. And with almost all of them, there's going to be some internet pornography. So I bring that up simply to say, when that's the main form of acting out, we get a lot of preoccupation. A preoccupation could go with any of the behaviors, but it's especially prominent in this. So that would be another symptom. So if the addict is not actually acting out, but spending a lot of time thinking about acting out, and now we're back to talking about the brain again, the goal isn't just abstinence from problematic behavior. The goal is to heal the brain. And so if the behavior's not there, but the thinking is there, that blocks the healing in the brain. So that's a problem. But I bring it up not so much to talk about healing the brain, but just to say that's one of the other predominant symptoms to look at, is the preoccupation. So along
well, absolutely,
that.
And you know, obviously, if crack, if cocaine, if heroin were available free of charge at any time, any way, any place, we'd have many, 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 many more addicts. And so you couple the fact that sex addiction is anonymous, affordable, and accessible, and then you think about the fact that the brain activity is looking at more things in their lifetime within a period of 20 minutes than what used to occur in a month. I mean, the brain is really having to shift and take snapshots of different things so quickly that I know that there's a lot of people that feel like there are chemicals we've never even seen before because of the fact that this is activity the brain has never been used to. I mean, pornography
right.
is in itself a very, very unusual situation that we have never seen in terms of brain activity in our lives.
Yeah. The other, just to support what you just said, Carol, which I think is so accurate and so important, I'm just coming off 12 days of intensive group therapy with sex addicts. And my programs last for 4 days. So this is 3 programs in a row. And I bring this up just to say I've spent a lot of time just in the most recent 12 days being face-to-face with sex addicts. And I want to tell you, the number one thing they were all talking about is their big problem is They go to bed at night. They get to sleep. They wake up in the middle of the night, and they get the urge to act out. Now, just think about that. In the old days, they might have to get up, get dressed, go out where they can get their porn or whatever they're going to do. They're going to say, oh, it's the middle of the night. I don't know what's open. I don't really want to go out. It's raining. They might talk themselves out of it. But look how it is now. I said to one of the guys that, yeah, all you've got to do now is put your feet on the floor and walk over to the den where your computer is. And he said, heck, I don't even have to do that. I've got my iPod right there on my nightstand. I don't even have to put my feet on the floor. It's right there. So I'm not saying that to make excuses for them. I'm just saying that it really is difficult when internet porn is one of the behaviors. But even as difficult as that is, we know for a fact that sex addicts can be abstinent from those behaviors that are problematic, especially if they're in a relationship. And that's the main thing that I want to move on to, Carol, when it fits your agenda, is last time I was on, we talked mostly about treating the addict, but I want to remind people that when there's a marriage or a partnership, we've got three entities. We've got the addict, we've got the betrayed partner, and we've got the coupleship. And in order to get to a place that relationship can work with these same two people, of course, the first thing we need is sobriety. As I already said, I would never encourage the betrayed partner to stay with someone who is still acting out. But once sobriety is established, there's so much work still to be done in order to create a new relationship together that works. And it can be done. That's mostly what I wanted to talk about tonight, if we can.
Well, let's do it, because I know partners are always concerned about this issue. So go ahead. More about that.
Okay. I think I'm going to talk mostly about that third entity, which is the coupleship. But first, I want to say this about the partner. Sometimes the partner, the betrayed partner, is resistant to getting her own, I'm saying he and she here, let me apologize for that. It could be the other gender, but in my work, I treat mostly male addicts and mostly female partners, so I'll slip up on that gender from time to time. I apologize.
Okay.
oftentimes the partner will be resistant to doing their own work, and I think sometimes that comes from the idea that they're trying to push me into treatment as if this is my problem. It's not my problem. It's the addict's problem. Or they're trying to blame me for the behavior. And I just want to say, that's not what's going on. What's going on is, for the partner, this is a trauma event. And the good news is that trauma wounds can be healed. The bad news is they don't heal by themselves. You know, we don't see spontaneous healing. The traumatized, betrayed partner needs to do some work to heal that trauma. So it's not about shifting the blame to the partner. It's about getting the partner the help they need.
Right,
and
right, absolutely.
I felt badly last time that I didn't say that, because obviously we've got X number of sex addicts, and most of them are in relationships, so we've got an equal number of betrayed partners, and they need help too. But even if the help is there, they got to be willing to get the help. Okay, so that's my little sales pitch for you partners that might be listening. I hope you'll... But when I said trauma wounds don't heal spontaneously, let me give you this one example. I think we all have seen on the news with these young people returning from the war zones, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq, these veterans from a war zone are returning, and huge numbers of them are suffering from PTSD.
Right.
We really understand a lot more about trauma these days than we used to. But my point about spontaneous healing, we are still getting veterans from Vietnam showing up, still suffering from PTSD. Back when they returned, we didn't know as much about it. We didn't do as good a job diagnosing it and treating it. And these people now, for all these decades, have been struggling with life because nobody ever diagnosed them with trauma. Nobody ever treated them to help them heal those trauma wounds. So I bring that up as the example to say if those old wounds would heal by themselves, those old Vietnam vets we wouldn't see them coming out of the woodwork still. That would be all done. And so it's the same thing with addiction. It's a trauma disorder for the partner. And I'm encouraging you to get your own help, whatever your addict does or doesn't do. Okay, and then there's the coupleship, and I've been calling tonight the third entity, the addict, the betrayed partner, and the coupleship. One of the things that I tell couples who are just beginning to deal with this in the face of sex addiction is that the betrayal has been so great that the old relationship cannot be repaired. And, of course, that's very discouraging to some people because they come to therapy because they want to repair the old relationship. But I start right out in the first session saying the damage is too great, you can't repair it. What you can do, if the addict stays sober and does the work of moving into advanced recovery after sobriety, and if that sobriety is consistent and uninterrupted, then the addict and the partner can choose to be together and create something brand new together that is better than anything they ever had. That's the approach that I take with couples. And keep in mind, I've been doing this since the 80s. So when I say that's an approach that works, I've got a lot of experience. I can point to a lot of couples who are still together to this day because, number one, their sobriety. Number two, they've done the work to create the new relationship. They're not focused on fixing the old one. In fact, a lot of times I'll even encourage my sex addiction couples to actually go through some kind of a ritual of letting the old relationship die, be done, and then going on to create the new one. That's, in my experience, that's what works.
And so how do you do that? How does that work where you let them die? And then
I know
how you would recreate the new ones, because obviously that's all about the proper support and doing the right recovery tools and healing the deeper wounds. But how do you let them die?
Yeah, and I encourage the couple to actually create their own ritual to mark that event. And it depends, what would the ritual be? It depends a lot on what part of the country you live in. I'll give you a couple examples. I'm on the shore of Lake Michigan, and a lot of people where I live will actually write things down. Both people write things down about the old relationship that was so painful and didn't work. Actually write it down, and then what they do after they get all this negativity and all these old memories and old and emotional pain, they get that all out and they get it on paper, they wrap that paper around a brick and tie it up, and then walk out to the end of the pier in Lake Michigan and throw it out and let it be done. It sinks into about 40 feet of water right there at the end of the pier, and it's gone. But another ritual that couples could do, I said a lot of this is dependent on what part of the country you live in, but here's one that would apply to wherever you are. Burning is a great way to do this stuff. So again, you'd have all this negativity written down, and maybe there's even, in addition to the things you write, there might even be some symbolism of various kinds. And you get that all together and burn it. And again, let it be done. So I've done a lot of my work in Arizona, right in the desert, and we'll literally walk out into the desert wilderness and bury this stuff. So, I mean, I've given you three examples there, but what I...
And you know, Paul, one of the things I know is that the primal brain doesn't know the difference between pretending to have a funeral for something and going to the funeral. And so when you say bury it, burn it, beat it, whatever, drown it, that's it. That is a great way of letting it go so that you can move on and create a healthier relationship. So those were great examples of how to do that. And of course, you really... You can do it on your own, but it helps if you've got a therapist that's willing to do that kind of gestalt work with you.
Right, right. But even with the help of a good therapist, I think it's important for the couple themselves to get creative enough to create their own ritual. And if they're having trouble figuring it out, I mean, a therapist will have experience with this so that they can throw in little crumbs to get the couple started on what they're going to do. But to go along with what you just said, Carol, to make this real, I'm calling it ritual, but we want to take it beyond ritual. We want it to feel real. And
absolutely. And let me ask you something, because, again, you're right. It is great for the couple to create these things. And I bet you, I don't know exactly about your intensives. I certainly read a lot about them. But I know that I do that kind of work in men's group with men who need to bury some of their own stuff so that they can move on personally. And I bet that you do that in some couples' intensive work, do you not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's very much part of it. And I mean, the idea is that, what we're trying to help the couple get to eventually is putting their energy into creating this brand new relationship. And when I present that I've got a standard way that I say it, and I say it this way because it's true. You can create something brand new that's better than anything you ever had before. See, so often couples come to therapy when they're ready to focus on the coupleship. They come in thinking they're going to repair the old, and they're hoping somebody can help them get the good old days back. And so my point was, I tell them right up front, you're not going to get the good old days back, but the good news is you're going to get something that's even better. But in order to move on to that.
And of course that gives them hope, strength, and recovery, because clearly when you believe that you can create a better relationship than you've ever had or that you've ever had in your life, it does give you incentive to really work hard at letting go of the old and creating the new.
Exactly. But I think before any couple can really focus on what they're going to create new, they do have to end the old. And that's how we got into talking about those rituals. But, you know.
Now, can I ask you something that I know is a sensitive topic for so many partners? And I know what I believe, and I know the changes that I've seen, but I'm curious. You know that in the past, the term co-addict has been the reference for a partner. And I'm wondering, what do you think of the term co-addict?
Oh, I bet there are a bunch of your listeners out there right now who are just cringing to even hear the word. I avoid that word at all costs. And again, I've been in this field for such a long time. I was around, and I've got to admit, I was even one who used to use the word. And in retrospect, it was a huge mistake because back to something I said earlier, it's a label that implies that the betrayed partner caused or at least contributed to the addiction. And not to say that these partners were perfect in relationship, but I do want to be crystal clear. They didn't cause the addiction. Most of these addicts, you know, a lot of us who treat addiction use this term. What's the original wound? Addicts, I don't care what form of addiction, addicts are medicating. And what are they medicating? They're medicating some old wound that typically goes way back into early childhood. And, of course, this would go way back before they even knew the partner. And so if we're going to talk about causes, I mean, what we're looking for nowadays is a childhood trauma, attachment disorder, just the wounds that result from growing up in a dysfunctional family. And that's what we need to be focused on. And we're distracted from that when we use that term co-addict and put that on the partner. But let me say quickly, I think some of your listeners might be interested and maybe even less offended if they understood the history of where that word comes from. Back in the 70s, when we were sort of at a peak of treating alcoholism in an inpatient setting, pretty much everybody, if they could afford it, and most insurance would pay for it back in those days, unlike today. So addicts, I mean alcoholics, in great numbers were treated in inpatient treatment centers. And somebody back then decided it was politically incorrect to call them the alcoholics, that it was shaming. So they started calling them the addict instead of the alcoholic. And then along the lines of addiction being a family disease, they call the partner the co-addict. And they really didn't mean to say that the partner caused it, but it was just a term they used to differentiate between who's the addict and who's the partner. But when partners get offended with that label, and if I were a partner, I'd be offended by that label too, so I totally support anyone on that. But if you don't like that term, don't let anybody put that on you. Just say, don't call me that. And if you're not going to use the term co-addict, what term describes you? And you may have noticed the term I'm using all the time is the betrayed partner. And, that doesn't shame you, and that doesn't blame you, but it's very descriptive for what happened to you.
Absolutely, and I'm glad that you gave us the history on that, as well as, let's face it, you're exactly right. Most addicts are medicating old traumatic wounds of their childhood. Now, you mentioned attachment disorder, and I'm curious, what role do you think attachment disorder plays in addiction? And explain to our listeners what you believe attachment disorder is.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, because it's, I think we're at a time, as you were saying earlier, Carol, where we really know so much about the neuroscience of all this. And the other thing that's right up there with the neuroscience is that we know, I'm going to talk about what attachment disorder is, but it's a wound that occurs typically very, very early. It's unlike some forms of child abuse that might happen at early teenage years or something. This might even go back to infancy. In fact, I don't want to say might. It typically would go back. Now, one of our colleagues, I don't know if you've ever had him on your show yet, but Rob Weiss is one of our colleagues that I've known for a long time, and he writes a very informative blog, and recently in his blog he actually put in there that we could use the term addict and attachment disorder interchangeably. He's saying that
interesting.
Yeah, attachment disorder is so prevalent in the history, I think not just of sex addicts, but of any addicts. But what is it? I think I'll describe it from the perspective of the infant. This infant needs that loving connection, ideally from both parents, but certainly from one primary parent. And when I say infant, so I'm talking about things that need to happen pre-verbally. And because it's pre-verbal, one of the ways I like to actually show this experientially in my groups, where I'll ask for permission, and if they give me permission to touch them, I'll put my hands on their face, and I'll move my face right in close to theirs, and I'll gaze into their eyes, and I'll be thinking about how much I respect this person and care about this person. And even though I'm doing that, adult to adult, I'm trying to show these people the loving gaze of the parent to this infant. And very often, that didn't happen. And if that didn't happen, that's just the beginning of attachment disorder. And this then becomes such a big part of not only treating the addiction, but it's such an important coupleship issue. Because if a person suffered attachment disorder way back in early childhood, we know now that one of the characteristics in adulthood is that person who had attachment disorder is very, very resistant to intimacy. And, of course, typically in these coupleships that aren't working, we've got one person who's starving for intimacy and the attachment disorder person who is terrified of intimacy. And I intentionally use the word terrified because we think, there's a lot of research on this, we think that a person with attachment disorder goes into adulthood and their greatest fear, their number one fear in life is fear of intimacy. And the interesting thing, I think, beyond that, is their primary fear is fear of intimacy with an underlying fear of abandonment. And when I show that to somebody for the very first time, I often say, do you see how you're setting yourself up for abandonment? You've got a partner who's starving to death for intimacy. You're afraid to show up and be intimate. Of course you're going to be abandoned. So this is, I hope I didn't go on and on with that, but
I agree with you. Between the attachment issues and the fear of rejection, it is very difficult to have any kind of intimacy at all. And so, of course, a lot of our work as therapists, whether we do intensives or group therapy or individual or couples work, is to help develop that intimacy by healing that attachment and that fear of rejection. And couples are phenomenal at helping each other to do that.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to address one other thing on coupleship. Is this an okay time to move to this? Okay.
No, feel free, yes. Please tell us more.
Yeah, okay. One of the things, one of the questions that comes up all the time, and this isn't just a question with the client couple. This is actually a question that's still coming up all the time, even among us therapists. And the question is, if you've got addiction, sex addiction, in the coupleship, what's the right time to start couples work? You know, great question, important question. And I think I'm in the camp where I recommend starting it sooner rather than later. But even though I'm saying start it sooner, there's still some requirements, as far as I'm concerned, before you start the couples work. Number one, the addict has to be sober. And if the addict is not sober, do not come in with the idea that, well, we'll work on the coupleship and we'll fix the relationship, and then he'll quit acting out. Well, I wish I could say it worked that way. It makes sense. It's a rational idea, but I haven't seen it work. What works is the first step needs to be the addict getting out of denial and following the aftercare plan, whatever it is. I know you talk a lot about 12-step on your show, and I'm a big fan of 12-step. So, I mean, I would say that the sex addict would need to be in 12-step, would need to be in therapy, would need to be in group therapy. And of course, I skipped right over inpatient treatment. The only reason I skipped over that is it's so expensive, and if insurance doesn't cover it, a lot of people that would benefit from inpatient can't get it. But if you're in that situation, I want to say don't be discouraged, because if you get with a good therapist with experience on treating this, there are enough tools to help the addict get sober and stay sober that even if inpatient is not available, these other things will work. But I'm saying the addict must be sober, must be in recovery, and I don't know if anybody's picked up on this. I'm using a couple of terms here, and they're not really interchangeable. I'm talking about sobriety, and I'm talking about recovery. They're two different things. You know, when we talked about childhood trauma, when we talked about attachment disorder, that's recovery work. And healing those old wounds, again, like I said about the betrayed partner, that doesn't happen automatically just because an addict gets sober. But the person can't deal with those other recovery issues until they are sober. So it's sobriety first. It's following the treatment plan and doing that consistently without slips or relapse for at least 90 days. And if the addict has done that, the addict can be in a place now to put some of the addict's attention and energy and time into focusing on that other entity, which is the coupleship. Now, during those 90 days that the addict is focused on the addict, it would be wonderful if the betrayed partner was doing some work, too, to heal the partner's wounds.
Exactly. And so, absolutely.
What I'm saying, in those first 90 days, if we've got two people and they're each focused on themselves, then they get to a place pretty quickly that they can focus on the third entity, the coupleship. But there are professionals out there that would still say, no, 90 days, that's too soon. Well, it's too soon if the addict's not sober. Maybe it's too soon if the betrayed partner hasn't done any trauma work. But if they've both done what I'm talking about, they're ready. And they're eager. They don't want to keep living in this broken thing that we call a marriage or a partnership. They want it to be better. Or they don't know what they want. That's the other thing, too, is so often, especially the partner, should I stay or should I go? And getting into couples therapy can help answer that question. Actually, I hadn't planned ahead to say that, but I'm glad I did, because I think that's another thing that would keep the partner away from couples therapy is, well, I haven't decided yet if I'm going to commit to this. I haven't decided yet if I'm going to stay. Well, you don't have to decide that before you go to therapy. You use therapy to help you make that choice.
100%. And you know what? I could talk about this for hours, because I have said to you before, Paul, the addict carries the shame, but it is the partner that carries the pain. And, you know, we didn't even get to polygraphy, you know, in terms of, well, how do you use a polygraph for, and when do you do disclosure? But we have to end. So I so appreciate the fact that you've done a fabulous job of explaining all this to us. And, you know, you are a very, very wise person. How can people get a hold of you? Are you still doing the intensives? I know you moved, right?
Well, it's a seasonal move. I haven't really moved. In the summer, I do my intensives in Grand Haven, Michigan, in a wonderful place right on the shores of Lake Michigan. And then in the winter, I do my work in Florida. So that's partly selfish. That's partly for me, but it's also for the clients that if people are going to fly in to work with me, I mean, who wants to fly into Michigan in February? So,
well, you're exactly right there. So now tell our listening audience, how can they get a hold of you? How can they get on your mailing list and what you got coming up next?
My website is Pathway. Pathway is singular. There's no S on the end of it. PathwayToHealing.com. And that describes all of my programs for the addict, for the partner, for the couple. And I can do that intensive work one-to-one, or I can do it in a group setting. But back in the 90s, I closed down my traditional private practice because I didn't want to do the hour-a-week thing anymore.
Uh-huh.
Not to be critical of anybody that does that, but I was getting older. I'd been doing this for a long time, and I just didn't want to keep doing something that moved along so slowly. So I switched over to these intensives, and that's all I do now. And the outcomes are fantastic. I don't have statistics on this, but I'm confident that our recovery rates with these intensives are as good as people that go to 5 or 6 weeks of inpatient.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah,
okay,
pathwaytohealing.com, and that will, if you look there, that gives you my email address and phone number, and you don't have to be ready to commit to do a program. If you've just got questions, feel free to call, and I'll talk to you no charge and try to answer your questions. Or if you do want
to
do a program,
thank you very much. We are talking with Paul Hartman, again, PathwayToHealing.com. And I so appreciate your help. You know I would love to have you back because you explain things so well, simple, but very, very in-depth. And again, I just so appreciate your contribution to this field.
Well, thank you, Carol. It's a treat to be with you, and it's easy to sound like an expert with you because you do such a good job leading us through this. So you do a great job. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. You've got to promise me if you're going to be at the symposium next year, we got to have lunch.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Yes. You take care and good luck to you. Thanks again.
Thank you, Carol. Bye.
Uh-huh. So that was Paul Hartman again, Pathway to Healing. And he has over 35 years of experience, and he's an amazing man. He has worked with some of my friends, some of my colleagues, and certainly many of my clients. All right. Well, thanks for another wonderful show. Thanks for listening. For my partners out there, I just so appreciate you hanging in there and wanting to get healthy, because I know that you've been traumatized too. And for the addicts, there is hope, strength, and recovery. When you work the program, it certainly works. Keep listening. We'll see you next week for more of Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. Have a great week.